Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. elite media have heralded Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, as a reformer, young and brash, as the New York Times editorial board had it, who is uplifting women in particular in the monarchy. It takes a lot to upset a narrative, particularly from a country that's mainly only reported in terms of its strategic partnership with, i.e., usefulness to, powerful U.S. interests. But one would hope that reports that Saudi Arabia, under MBS, as he's called, is torturing women political prisoners would be sufficient. We'll talk about story versus reality with journalist Sarah Aziza. Also on the show, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz doesn't like the word billionaire. He'd prefer we speak of people of means. Thank you. Schultz is responding, touchily, to the increased willingness to engage seriously proposals to reduce wealth and income inequality in the U.S. We'll talk about some of those proposals, what they can and can't do, and why we need them all, with economist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the free book, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, and we're going to get straight to it. When Saudi Arabia officially lifted a ban on women driving last June, it made for a great photo op. Time magazine had a video feature in which they rode along with the country's first women taxi drivers. 60 Minutes had already declared Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman a liberator of women. For the New York Times editorial board, the young and brash leader is in some ways just what his country needs, because he would allow concerts and would consider reforming laws tightly controlling the lives of women. But U.S. media are only slowly coming to acknowledge that beyond the photo op lies a very different reality. Journalist Sarah Aziza writes on these issues, among others, for The Intercept, as well as other outlets. She joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Sarah Aziza.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you actually saw reporters swarming on the photo op of Saudi women driving, and one can see why. It's both a symbolic and a material change that seems to say that Saudi Arabia, under the influence particularly of Mohammed bin Salman, is on the road to reform. But subsequent and even previous events should tell us that that's not really the story here. What should we know about bin Salman as liberator of Saudi women?
Yeah, I would say that it is not the full story. It is true that there are some women, particularly who come from liberal families, middle or upper class families, who are enjoying the benefits of these, you know, limited reforms, the increased flexibility for women in the workforce and the ability to drive. It's no small thing, symbolically or practically. But on the much grander scale, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, is we often see him referred to in the press, has ushered in an era of really unprecedented crackdowns and repression of all forms of political speech, but also just a general chill of authoritarianism that's rendered even ordinary citizens afraid to speak about the royal family, to discuss their opinions whatsoever when it comes to the reforms that are happening in their society or even everyday topics, whether it's issues of culture or commerce. There's just this sense that, yes, there are movie theaters and concert halls. People are enjoying attending, but no one there feels the freedom to speak openly about anything anymore. On the issue of women in particular, it's perhaps the most monstrous paradox of MBS's reign so far is the way that he's branded himself as a liberator of women. He's defended to the foreign press that women in Saudi Arabia are equal, absolutely equal, and that he is just here to empower and raise them up. And in particular, in relation to the women driving, that's the most perhaps egregious and awful irony was that practically all of the women who had campaigned for the right to drive, some of them dedicating decades of their life to peaceful protest and demonstration and petitioning of the government to obtain the right to drive, among other rights, they were all in jail when the day finally came, when all of the reporters were swarming these open lots, these choreographed spectacles that looked so good on the front pages of newspapers with these smiling women. But in the meantime, the women that really had the legacy of pushing for these reforms were in detention. They have not yet faced trial or even formal charges, not yet had access to legal counsel, haven't seen their family. And we've had recent reports in the past few months that several of them at least have faced systemic torture and sexual abuse while in detention, at the same time that MBS was using their cause as evidence of his credentials as a reformer.
Well, when you wrote about this in 2018, you said that one activist said that maybe the crackdown has something to do with the regime not wanting the lifting of the ban to be seen as a reward for that activism. They'd prefer it be presented as a gift from the king.
Absolutely. That's been one of the themes of Bin Salman's reign, is this absolute top-down, unilateral approach that any rights or privileges granted to his subjects must be seen as coming directly from him and a product of his will and his will alone. And that there are no channels, there's no two-way channel between the people and the government, that they are not to have expectations of activism or organizing as bringing about any changes or demands. This is not a conversation. This is a patriarchal top-down granting or bequeathing of rights as he sees fit. So the locking up of these women journalists was a way, we think, of preempting any sort of credit-taking or any sort of celebration. The women were contacted ahead of time in some cases and told not to even tweet congratulations or in praise of the reforms, because that could be seen as attaching themselves to the outcome, and MBS wanted to fully control the narrative for himself.
Well, and then to go back for a moment to the women in prison and the reports of abuse, including torture, this is something new, this mistreatment, right, of women. This
right.
is not common exactly.
No, absolutely not. The concept of female political prisoners was pretty unheard of before MBS, and that comes back to, in a lot of ways, the sense of propriety, the patriarchal norms that in many ways, you know, harm women so much, but in another sense have these really stringent and old-fashioned ideas of modesty, where women are not meant to be publicly displayed in any way. But that really has fallen by the wayside in the case of many of these women activists. They were viciously attacked in the pro-government press. There was a smear campaign. They were identified as enemies of the state. Rumors of their connections to foreign governments, to Qatar, among other things, were just splashed across the front pages of local newspapers, and along with their pictures, which is, again, just such a transgression of modesty norms in the country. So it really just shows a willingness to transgress all normal bounds by MBS in order to push his narrative forward at whatever cost and victimizing whomever along the way.
The October 2018 disappearing and presumed murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Turkey was absolutely shocking. And yet the murder itself sort of got swallowed up in debate over how Trump or the U.S. should or would respond to it. What did you make of the treatment of Khashoggi's killing? What got lost, do you think, there in media coverage?
I think that what got lost the most, perhaps, are the long-term implications of allowing MBS to really, in an essence, get away with murder. You know, this is a young man who, although there are elements to his reign that may still be tenuous, he's really consolidated an unprecedented amount of power. And, you know, maneuvered his way into the crown prince position. His father is very old and ailing. And should this man, you know, succeed to the throne, we could be dealing with a Saudi Arabia led by MBS for 50 years to come, for decades. And it's an absolute monarchy at this point still. So the implications for millions of Saudis and for the world, as well as just the freedom of press in general and the violation of just the concept of journalism and dissent, all of these universal principles, presumably universal principles, seem to be just swept aside in favor of Trump and Jared Kushner's personal relationship with the Crown Prince and an unwillingness to perhaps endanger a lucrative arms deal or strategic interests against Iran. So it's a really short-sighted approach that was taken to Khashoggi's death, and it's really a travesty of justice and a tragedy for all those who knew him and for what he represents as a journalist and as a Saudi.
Well, let me ask you about, and you talked about this, but within Saudi Arabia, and, you know, outside of Thomas Friedman chatting with a cab driver, we don't hear much street-level storytelling, really. You reported that many Saudis are themselves unaware of the government's crackdown on activists. Like, it's not necessarily something that everyone is talking about or maybe comfortable talking about.
No, there's certainly a sense of confusion. There's a lot of obliviousness, definitely, apart from the smear campaign against Loujain Al-Hathloul and some of the other women's rights activists back in the summer of 2018. A lot of these arrests and disappearances they're emerging through Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports and social media, but they're going unmentioned in the local press. So there's a lot of confusion, a lot of lack of awareness. And then when there is awareness, there's an incredible reluctance to even admit knowing anything about these subjects. Everyone's worried that even having an interest, even following stories that are critical of MBS could render them liable to be called enemies of the state themselves, could be targeted for arrest or stigmatization or suspicion under this growing sense of a police state and thought police in a way. And you see that even the impact on social media, people shutting down their accounts, being unwilling, even their anonymous accounts, to be on Twitter or Facebook anymore, to even click on stories that they think might lead somewhere to a critical story. And I should just add that Saudi Arabia has been expanding and emphasizing their anti-cyber crime laws that really criminalize any use of media or propagating any information that might be seen as portraying the kingdom or the royal family in a negative light. So these are now criminal offenses, and everyone's just tiptoeing as far as their information and conversation surrounding any of these issues now.
It's amazing, in a way, that activism continues under these circumstances. Well, finally, I mean, outside of the false hope, if you will, that MBS is being portrayed as, where do you see real hope within Saudi Arabia?
Well, I speak to a lot of people, both inside and outside the country, and there seems to be a pretty unanimous opinion that the hope really lies outside of the borders of Saudi Arabia at this point, whether it's Saudis abroad who are advocating for their people, or it's journalists and activists, human rights groups, and foreign governments who it's really incumbent upon them to look at the evidence and admit what's so obviously there, that this is a dangerous leader, that he's taking Saudi Arabia into a really frightening direction, and that there needs to be meaningful sanctions and consequences for him now rather than later. Each time we let him get away with another violation or offense is another reinforcement in his mind that he has an impunity that renders him exempt from the rules. So, yeah, I was speaking to even one leading human rights activist from Saudi Arabia who's in exile now, self-exile, and she told me, my only hope is in the international community. Yet she does have hope. She says, I believe in my people and I believe in our women. They've overcome so much for decades, so they won't be stopped, but it's absolutely incumbent upon the rest of us to do our part too.
We've been speaking with Sarah Aziza. You can find her recent piece, Mohammed bin Salman is Running Saudi Arabia Like a Man Who Got Away with Murder, on TheIntercept.com, and a related piece, The Saudi Government's Global Campaign to Silence Its Critics, on NewYorker.com. More of her works at SarahAziza.com. Sarah Aziza, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
One in three GoFundMe campaigns in this country are for medical expenses. One in five households have zero or negative wealth. Millions of people are one paycheck away from hardship. And this is the same society in which there are people who can't remember how many houses they own or are puzzled about why furloughed federal workers would be going to food banks. Inequality is a life or death issue, which makes it especially disconcerting that some folks with media megaphones seem proudly ignorant of the basic mechanisms by which resources are distributed. Some myths and misunderstandings are being thrown into relief as we're seeing a strikingly bold, for recent times, conversation about progressive taxation, occasioned by proposals from New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. But if the present debate goes further than we're used to, does it go far enough? Dean Baker is co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us now by phone from Utah. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, corporate media have trouble or often don't bother to distinguish between ideas and those espousing them. So when Ocasio-Cortez suggests the idea of a top marginal tax rate of 70%, that gets sucked into the vortex of her coverage, you know, coverage of her, as with wealth tax proposals from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Before we talk about the limits of those ideas, I wonder if you could just talk a bit about both top marginal tax rates and increased taxes on extreme wealth, given that media often present those ideas as kind of ideas from Mars or proof that these politicians are wild-eyed fantasists.
Yeah, well, the reaction to both proposals has been fascinating, both the public reaction where there's clearly been a lot of support. People are saying, yeah, you have a lot of real rich people. Why shouldn't they pay more in taxes? But more so from the media and, you know, from some establishment politicians. So the reaction is, oh, here's flaky Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, where she'd get off 70%. And in fact, that's a number that many of the world's most prominent tax economists have said. This is the maximum tax rate. Maximum amount of revenue. And there was an article, widely read article, by Peter Diamond, who's a professor at MIT, and Manuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, both very, very prominent. Diamond won Nobel Prize, Saez, John Bates Clark Award, two of the most prestigious awards you can get in the profession. So these are people in very high standing. And they came up with that number. You know, and there were all sorts of qualifications and reservations. But in any case, they didn't think it was ridiculous. So when you have a fresh new member of Congress propose that, well, the media jumped on that like, oh, she's just being flaky. And in fact, it's a very reasonable thing to put on the table, whether that's the right rate. You know, of course, you could debate that. But it certainly was not a ridiculous proposal. And, you know, again, Paul Krugman had a very nice piece where he's contrasting that with the Republican proposals to cut taxes on the rich, where they were saying that they would pay for themselves, which was ridiculous. But that was treated like these are serious people. So it's been fascinating that there's been such a rush to dismiss these as kind of far-out proposals by radical leftists when they're reasonable proposals, which, again, is not to say that they're necessarily the best policy, but they're certainly reasonable proposals to put on the table and to be debated.
Well, we read that Michael Dell, who has $30 billion or so at the World Economic Forum, apparently said, name a country where that's worked ever, the 70% top marginal rate. Missing something, you could say.
Yeah, of course, the one of his co-panelists said the United States, because that was, in fact, the rate in the United States until Ronald Reagan lowered it with his tax cuts in 1981. And if we go back a little further, it was 90% in the Eisenhower days. Kennedy had lowered it to 70%. So again, one could argue whether these are the best rates, but to treat this as a crazy idea out of, you know, far left field is just wrong. And, you know, some of the back and forth, because I was on Twitter with Dell and, you know, there were others involved, obviously. And what I find most striking here, the Dell's kind of a poster child here, because what is Dell's expertise in this area? He's very rich, no doubt about that, but he obviously knows nothing about tax rates. I mean, again, we could disagree 70% the right rate, but to act like that's just impossible, we're going to see our economy collapse, that's nuts. He knows nothing about it. He just has $30 billion, so therefore he thinks he's qualified to talk about it.
Well, it's good, I think, that we're talking about taxing extremely high incomes and wealth for all kinds of reasons. The LA Times' Michael Hiltzik was saying,
you know, it helps move us away from this notion that wealth is self-made, you know, that these folks owe nothing to society, and it disrupts the fallacy of trickle-down. But having said that, it does take the form of a give-back. You know, you've got an absurd amount of money, so you should throw some back in the pot because that's the socially decent thing to do. You suggest in this recent piece for Truth Out that while that is not wrong, it's not getting to the crux, the bigger source of the rise in inequality.
Yeah, so the point I made in that piece, and really I've made in much of my writings over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, is that the distribution of income is not something that just happens. It depends on how we structure the economy. And I would say the economy is pretty much infinitely malleable. We could structure it all sorts of different ways. And my favorite example here, just because it's so blatant, is I like to say, how rich would Bill Gates be if he didn't have copyright or patent monopolies on Windows software? So if anyone in the world could just start producing, mass producing computers and copy in Windows and all the other Microsoft software, and they don't even have to send him a thank you note. Well, needless to say, he would not be one of the richest people in the world. He wouldn't have $100 billion. I'm sure he'd do fine. But, you know, the fact that someone like Bill Gates could become incredibly wealthy was because of how we designed that market. And it's pretty much the same story everywhere you look. Finance, where would all these Goldman Sachs guys be if we didn't have the bailout in 08 and we just let the market run its course? I mean, there's many other ways we subsidize finance as well. Corporate CEOs, they were always well paid. But if you go back to the pay standards of the 60s and 70s, they'd be getting $2 or $3 million a year, not $30 and $40 million. So we structure rules that allow people to get incredibly wealthy. And I really prefer that to be the focus, both because as a practical matter, it's much harder to get the money back once they have it. I mean, there's all sorts of practical issues that people have rightly raised. You know, when Elizabeth Warren says, let's tax the wealth, well, they're not just going to hand it over to you. It's going to be hard to do. It doesn't say it's not something we might want to do, but it's going to be hard. And secondly, the political issue. If we act as though, well, you know, Bill Gates got that fair and square, we shouldn't take any of it back. If you go, well, we could have kind of structured it differently, and then Bill Gates wouldn't have it, and then we don't even have to have this discussion.
I wonder, do you think it's a trap to talk about these things in terms of revenue, in terms of how much money it would bring to the economy? I read a piece by Vanessa Williamson from Brookings where she said that taxes on the very wealthy should be judged by their societal impact and not simply by their revenues, that it has to do with the fact that just having some people be so wildly wealthy is incompatible with democracy. And so we shouldn't get too hung up on how much money it would give to the economy to institute some of these changes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very important point. And I remember some years ago, there was a piece on the estate tax that was done by Alicia Manel, who's now at Boston College. And she came up with some figure that we get a relatively small amount of revenue, you know, from the estate tax. And I'm saying relatively small. It's still substantial, but much less than if you just said, oh, here's how many rich people died and we tax it at a 40% rate. Here's what we get a very small amount relative to that. But she wasn't writing it as a critic of the tax, because the two points she was making, one is exactly this one. The part of the story is we don't want massive amounts of wealth to be handed down, so you get Donald Trump or his kid, you know, walking away with billions and suddenly having all this political influence. But the other is, part of what they do to avoid the tax is do things like start foundations like the Ford Foundation and the Gates Foundation. Now, those aren't my dreams. I mean, there's a lot of bad things I could say about the way those foundations are run. But the point is, that's not altogether a loss for society, because they do some good things. So to act like, oh, they aren't going to pay the tax, they're just going to start a foundation that provides inoculations to children in Africa, well, that's not a bad thing. So to just look at it and say, okay, how much revenue are we getting from the tax, that is missing the point.
Well, and then, though, going back to Michael Dell, he said, you know, my wife and I set up a foundation and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 70% tax rate on my annual income. And I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private donation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
Well, I guess what I'd have to tell the Michael Dell, he still could do that.
Exactly. But I think what people are saying is, the problem isn't whether that's true in real numbers. The problem is running a society on noblesse oblige, you know?
Yeah, no, we don't want to have to depend on, you know, I wasn't going to go into my criticisms of the Gates Foundation and the others, but yeah, we don't want to depend on their goodwill. I mean, people need health care, they need education, you know, all the other necessities of life, and it shouldn't depend on whether Michael Dell's, he and his wife are good people and they're going to contribute to that. I mean, it's nice if they want to, but that shouldn't be what we depend on.
Well, a poll from that Pinko Rag Business Insider showed that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, the 70% top marginal tax rate, was more popular than the GOP tax cuts, which you alluded to before. People don't even think that socialism is a curse word anymore, which removes a real arrow from some folks' quiver. But I think we want to say that none of these proposals working on pre-tax income, post-tax income, they're not opponents of one another as proposals, right? And other things like raising the minimum wage could fit in there, too. I guess it just does seem like more ideas are on the table than we've grown accustomed to. And I wonder how we keep that window open and how we keep pushing for more.
Well, it has been great that, you know, you have people put it on the table and there's been a good popular response. And I have to say, to some extent, our best allies under this have been the Republicans, the conservatives, because they've said things that are just so absurd. I mean, I remember Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, was criticizing Ocasio-Cortez's 70% proposal, and he's talking to his account. He's talking to fifth graders, and he says, so you do some work for your grandmother, and she gives you $10, and the government takes $7 of it. And he goes, and they all go, that's not fair. Of course, it has nothing to do with her proposal. She's talking about people get over $10 million, so over $10 million. And so I don't know whether Scott Walker literally doesn't understand a marginal tax rate, or he's just being dishonest about it, but he publicized this, and needless to say, he got raked over the coals for it. My guess is he won't do that again. But it has certainly pushed the window on how we could talk about these things. So in that sense, we don't all have to agree that A, B, or C is the best, or, you know, what I would say is we probably want a mix of A, B, and C. But in any case, it certainly expanded the window of discussion in a really positive way.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker. He is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They're online at CEPR.net, and that's where you can also get hold of Dean's free book called Rigged. His piece, Progressive Taxes Only Go So Far, Pre-Tax Income is the Problem, can be found at truthout.org. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine. Good to be on again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.